crack in the system, you know, obviously refers to a variety of things. One is obviously crack, the effect.
It's a great name, great title. You came up with that?
Yes, I did. Because the other side is the crack that allows you to peek into how the system really works. And I think that's what this story for me, and what when you asked at the beginning and what attracted me, is that this gives us a glimpse into this behemoth, this beast, this Leviathan of a crazy system and how it actually operates. So I hope people take advantage, and I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, Mark Levin, thank you for joining us.
You got it.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank Mark Levin for joining us. I'd like to thank Daniel Voll for his help with today's show and the entire Sojourner Truth team, our engineer, and of course, our assistant producer. Love to hear from you. You could email me directly. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the year tomorrow. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Pascoe.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of
KBOO
our
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bag and Baggage Productions presents The Tempest, performing from Thursday, August 11th through Sunday, August 28th in Hillsboro. This bilingual adaptation of William Shakespeare's The Tempest will be performed throughout various parks in Hillsboro. The Tempest is a story of love, redemption, forgiveness, and the nature of storytelling. That's Bag and Baggage Production presents The Tempest, performing from Thursday, August 11th through Sunday, August 28th in Hillsboro. More information can be found at kb.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website, kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend meetings are available on the website. The Finance Committee will meet on Thursday, August 18th at 5:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being
held. This is Cesar Chavez. You're listening to KBOO, listener-sponsored radio.
Reproductive justice organizations and activists have been fighting for people living in a post-war reality for as long as our history exists, you know? And so none of this is new information. I found myself pregnant at 17 in a state where you can't get an abortion as a minor without parental consent, and I could not tell my family because they would have made me get married because those were their values.
Welcome back to Raw on the Rocks. I'm Claire Rosciato. Today I will be speaking with a storyteller based in Tennessee, one of the 12 states with a trigger law. Bans that fully or seriously restrict abortion, and last June were triggered into effect when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe. Tennessee's ban, starting on August 25th, outlaws all abortions with no exceptions for rape or incest. Back in April of this year, just months before Roe would be overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court, I spoke with Julie Edwards, the Patient Advocacy Programs Manager for Planned Parenthood of Tennessee and Northern Mississippi, about their work elevating the stories of patients who for years were already living in a post-Roe America.
So in my role, I really fortunately get to hear patient stories every day. So anytime you see or hear an abortion story connected to like Tennessee, that is one that I found and interviewed, and you know, I help coach our storytellers on how to like tell a really compelling and powerful story. And yeah, through that, we try and advocate for like changing hearts and minds through people's personal experiences. And it has been the most powerful work that I've ever done.
That's great. And how do you share those stories? Is that just part of any promotional materials, like on social media? Or do you try to connect those stories, or both, to local journalists or national journalists to share those stories? How does that work?
Yeah. All of the above.
Nice.
So we will use stories in our social media, or we'll encourage our storytellers to share their stories on their own social media pages if they kind of want to get their toes in the water. And yeah, we also have journalist opportunities, articles, interviews, video interviews too. And then we also prep those storytellers for speaking at rallies or marches or speak out. So kind of anything under the sun, which makes what I do really cool because every opportunity looks a little bit different.
I bet. And what can you share about, what are you learning from patients in recent times, or we're speaking right now in April of 2022, over the past couple of months, especially with new legislation coming out in Tennessee, and then obviously what's going on with the U.S. Supreme Court case with Mississippi, how are folks feeling? And what are they sharing with you about how they're feeling about how the direction of abortion is going in both those states?
Yeah, I think that there are kind of two reactions. People either don't know what's happening, which is fair, or people are really, really scared. And rightfully so, because abortion access really does, like, hang in the balance. We are closer to losing access both here in the state and nationally than I think we've ever been since Roe passed. And for a lot of people, that reality hasn't set in yet. But for those who know realistically, like, where we are, everyone is looking for something to do, looking for an action to take, looking for a way to fight back.
And what are some of those ways that people are looking to fight back? Is that through activism, working with local legislators? How does that look?
Yeah, it kind of ranges around, like, what people's comfort levels are and how they're already plugged into their community.
Mm-hmm.
For a lot of people, fighting back really does just look like sharing their story for the first time. And that's just as powerful as showing up or marching in the streets or going to a protest. And then we have other folks who have been with us at the state legislature every time an anti-abortion bill has been heard. They've met with their legislators, helped us phone bank or write letters or postcards. They've, you know, organized their friends and had house parties and, you know, tried to get their communities together in the ways that they can to educate them and let them know what's going on. And all of those pieces are important because they all go to work together to help us build power.
And before we get into some of the nitty-gritty of what's legally going on, I'm curious, what about this issue has kept you, what drew you into getting involved but also staying? Because I can imagine, if this is something you're passionate about, you know, protecting the right to safe and legal abortion, and hearing all these stories, I could see how it could become overwhelming. What first drew you in, given all of your background with sex education and sexuality, and then what's kept you staying and continuing being a storyteller advocate?
So I grew up in a really, really deeply rural part of Tennessee, and I was raised by my grandparents, who are really deeply religious. And because of where I grew up and because of the narrative around, like, sex and healthy relationships that I grew up with in my family, I had a really terrible sex education experience. It was really awful. It involved, you know, a gym teacher taking a bunch of us aside and saying, you know, who here likes brand new clothing? And being, like, middle school girls, we were all like, yeah, we thought we were about to get new clothes. And she said, you know, boys aren't that different. They like brand new things too. That's why you should wait until marriage to have sex. And when I tell you that was the only sex education I received growing up, I wish I was exaggerating. And yeah, I remember knowing, like, feeling deep in my gut that that was just wrong. So I went home to my grandmother and told her what had happened, and she said, yeah, that's pretty much it.
Wow. So you didn't learn a lot about sex, let alone, it sounds like, your own body and how it functions.
No, and let alone, like, what healthy relationships look like.
Sure.
So when I was a teenager and I met someone who was a lot older than me and he said, you know, well, I love you, don't you love me? I thought that that's just what you did. Like, I didn't even know enough about sex to know that I, like, could say no or to know what coercion looked like. And so I found myself pregnant at 17 in a state where you can't get an abortion as a minor without parental consent. And I could not tell my family because they would have made me get married because those were their values. And I knew come hell or high water, that was not gonna be it for me. And so some of the people in my life helped me get abortion pills, and I had a self-managed abortion, and that changed the entire trajectory of my life. That really was the first time that I realized every safe adult I had in my life had drastically failed me in irreparable ways. And then I went to college and decided that that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to help people get the information that I didn't get. And I didn't want anyone else to go through what I had gone through. And then I met other people who had also had abortions, and I could finally tell people. And I found my community, and I found something that I felt really like worthy advocating for, because not a lot of people do this work, because it is hard and thankless at times and feels like we're constantly, you know, taking 2 steps forward, 10 steps back when it comes to what happens in the legislature. And I think for a lot of people that could turn you away really quickly from work like this. But for like myself and the people that I'm fortunate enough to work with, I think that that just makes us grittier and more determined somehow, because, and these are kind of my personal politics coming into play, but the institutions were never going to save us. You know, like, we as people have to be here for our people. And I think that's what keeps me coming back. It's not about the laws for me. It's about the people who need help.
Thank you for sharing your story. That's very powerful, and I think very necessary for listeners to get an understanding of this issue and also where you're personally coming from and why this is so important. Especially right now, given what is legally happening. You mentioned that it's, for you, it's not about the laws, it's about what's actually happening with people. Can you talk about, you know, you grew up in what I think a lot of folks outside of the South imagine, somewhere that's, you know, rural, very religious, and very lacking, as you explained in your experience, in sexual education. Can you talk about, as you carried on through into adulthood and you found your community, you found your purpose, how did you respond when I would imagine you most likely received pushback from folks who are against abortion? And that was what it sounds like, a message that you received growing up young. How did you continue to hold on to your values regarding abortion?
Yeah, I think it's really important to name that while I have received pushback from, you know, several different outlets in my life around what I do and the values that I hold and around abortion more broadly outside of me. And while I do get a lot of that, I get double the amount of people telling me that, you know, we've helped them and that they were completely alone in this before they met us. And when you hear stories like that, or when you hear people's personal experiences having abortions, it becomes so much deeper than just something personal. It becomes something that you just know and feel like is right. And I think the set of values that I've come to cultivate around abortion and around what freedom and liberation look like. I think I do this out of a hope for a better world, and maybe that makes me an unrealistic optimist, but I have to believe that people are capable of change. I just have to, because that used to be me, you know, like, growing up when I didn't know any better, I didn't have the right tools or the right information, I was also very anti-abortion because that's what I had grown up in. And here I am sitting a completely different person because of the things that I've experienced and the people that I've talked to and the people who have, you know, had the guts to help me walk through that and get to where I am. And so, yeah, I can't abandon that core belief that people can change, the world can change. That's what drowns out all of the pushback at the end of the day, because I know what I'm working towards.
And then just getting into a little bit of the politics, how do you respond then to folks who say, you know, you say that you want to change the world for the better. Can you explain what do you mean by that? What does that look like in the work that you do, making the lives of the patients that you advocate for easier when it comes to abortion access?
I think that for me, that looks like completely realized bodily autonomy and self-determination. I think that that means universal health care. I think that that means addressing access challenges elsewhere, because, you know, even before these laws were on the books, we were already in an access crisis. Like, a post-Roe world was already a reality for so many, like, people and communities of color and low-income folks and undocumented people. And so there are people who have been living in a post-Roe world, and I want to see barriers to access get completely removed. And I think a lot of that looks like actually taking care of and investing in our people. It looks like economic justice. It looks like, you know, providing food and housing and education for everyone. It looks like providing comprehensive sex education and birth control at free to low cost. It looks like, you know, making sure that people have the surroundings and the resources in their local communities to set themselves up for success, to be able to determine what they want their futures to look like outside of governmental control.
Thank you for explaining what you mean by the barriers, you know, that intersect with just what would be a barrier to accessing the abortion, like economics, universal health care. I don't know if you mentioned this, but things like childcare, things that are other variables that aren't just directly getting an abortion. Before we get more into the barriers, can you talk about what do you mean that many people, when you say many people, do you mean Tennesseans and North Mississippians?
I mean nationally. Like, okay. There are so many people everywhere all over the United States that are currently living in a post-Roe world, even in states that have the most access or the, like, you know.
No, that's something that I covered in previous episodes in this podcast, which is many Oregonians, rural Oregonians and Eastern Oregonians have many just geographical barriers to accessing abortion, which will be even more challenging given Idaho's current and then future legislation that can go into place. So I hear what you're saying, that this isn't just what's happening in your state and neighboring states, that it's a national issue. If there's anything else you'd like to add, can you explain what you mean that folks throughout the country, even in states like progressive states like Oregon, California, New York, are living in a post-Roe America already?
I think if I could add anything, I would add that, you know, this isn't new by any means. Reproductive justice organizations and activists have been fighting for people living in a post-Roe reality for as long as our history exists, you know. And so none of this is new information. I think that it feels timely and it feels urgent because of what we're seeing in state legislatures and more nationally at the Supreme Court. But I think it's a really sobering reminder to know that, like, we are not the first to be doing this work, because this issue has always been at hand for many people. And I think in a way that's really encouraging, because that also means we don't have to recreate the wheel. You know, we're not the first to try to fight back against something like this. There's a really robust foundation of incredible reproductive justice organizing that has been laid out for us, that kind of teaches us how to fight back, both in our communities and at a more systemic level.
I'd like to talk about the direct barriers that patients you advocate for face on a daily basis. If we can talk more about the barriers, so geographical distance to clinics, 48-hour waiting periods, and then other mandatory requirements like state-directed counseling and a mandatory ultrasound, and then viewing and description of that ultrasound. Can you explain what folks are experiencing when it comes to accessing abortion healthcare?
Yeah. I love that you went ahead and named sort of all of the restrictions that are currently in Tennessee law around abortion. And I think that when we talk about the reality of what those restrictions look like when they play out in an abortion patient's experience, they are actually like a lot more detrimental than we think. So the 48-hour waiting period, for example, we, at least here in Nashville, where I'm based, the amount of abortion patients we see, the majority of them are from outside of Nashville, actually traveling into Nashville to see us to get the care that they need. So these are people coming from rural parts of Tennessee, sometimes upwards of, you know, a 3 to 4 hour drive, or they're people coming from out of state, because we have been seeing a lot of people, you know, come to us after the fallout of what's happening in Texas and Oklahoma. And so the 48-hour waiting period is twice the amount of travel, twice the amount of time off work, twice the amount of childcare, you know, and all of those are additional burdens outside of just having to make 2 appointments. You know, it's so much bigger than I think what people realize, and it's really unrealistic for a lot of people to accomplish. And so, yeah, that's just one example of how the barriers that are already in place make abortion already so difficult for so many people to access. And these barriers, you know, basically, like, there's no need to make accessing an abortion any harder than it already is, because it's already not a reality for so many people, because they can't swing the, you know, like double the time off work, or because of like staffing issues. I've heard a lot of patient stories talking about the 48-hour waiting period where they'll say, like, I came in for my first appointment. I really needed my second appointment to be within like a 48 to 72 hour window because of where I was in the pregnancy, how many weeks pregnant I was. And because of staffing issues, that second appointment ended up being 2 weeks later. And that pushed me from a medical abortion over the gestational limit threshold to having to have a surgical abortion. And the difference in cost for those things is a matter of sometimes upwards of $1,000. And so if you're already struggling to pay for your abortion, like, that makes your abortion like unobtainable for you. So yeah, those are just a few examples of how these barriers already play out in the reality of our patient experiences. And I can talk more about other abortion restrictions also and what those look like if you'd like.
I'd appreciate that. And as you do that, and if I can prompt you or ask you rather, if it's not mentioned, I'd be really curious to also hear about Tennessee's ban on telemedicine and how long that's been in place, if you don't mind sharing how that impacted you and also impacts the patients that you work with.
Yeah. So because we also have a ban on telemedicine appointments for abortion, that means that every single abortion appointment that happens in the state of Tennessee, both your first appointment, like your consultation, and your second appointment where you actually get the procedure or get prescription, those all have to happen in person. And so for people living in rural parts of the state, that's just not feasible. But believe it or not, our telemedicine abortion ban was in place well before the pandemic ever started and wasn't really like brought to light how cruel that is and what a restriction that is in terms of, if you look at, you know, people who are immunocompromised or people who are disabled, like their barriers to care that they need. That was really brought to light in the pandemic when, you know, any other healthcare provider outside of a reproductive sphere would be able to like prescribe you medicine over like telehealth appointments. And here we are at the height of a global pandemic where a healthcare setting provides even more COVID-induced anxiety for a lot of people. And we're requiring them to come in person to a health center in order to get a prescription for pills that are prescribed over the counter outside of America, you know? So it just makes things even harder in terms of travel and also in terms of health and safety for abortion patients who have to come in person and see us.
This is Claire Rosciato with KBFM, and you're listening to Row on the Rocks, a limited series podcast about what abortion access looked like in America while Row was still the law of the land. Music in this episode is Ragtime by Peerless, courtesy of Epidemic Sound. Tune in next Thursday at 9 a.m. to hear more.